he found us at our internet website at GSL in New York. And he and his wife are on his way to the international convention next week. And he called one time and a few times, but the first time he said, "What's the Soberfest?" "This is John from Australia." I was like, "What?" I ended up playing the message about three times because did I just hear that right? So when we finally, the first time we talked, it was probably the first time, I got so excited about talking with him, and I was explaining the Soberfest, and it was the quick thinking of the chairperson, and I asked him, he must have thought I was out of my mind because I tried to calm myself down enough to ask him, would he be our speaker tonight? And he said, yes. So I was like, this is great. So then I go to the state, and I said, guess where our Saturday night speaker is from? He's from Australia. And they're going, what? I'm like, no, really, it's true. Hence, he's here, and he's here. And I was talking with my sponsor, you know, that's a lot of trust for someone to come halfway around the country to an event that he's never been to before. Halfway around the world, I did it again. And the sobriety countdown is... you know what I mean. Came halfway from around the world to an event he's never been to before, meeting people they've never met before. That's a lot of trust. That's a lot of faith in our program and a higher power that got him here. And with that, it's my honor to present John R. from New South Wales, Australia.
Good evening, friends. John's my name, and I'm an alcoholic. Now, hang on a minute. By the time my wife and I get back home, between us, we'll probably have travelled 50,000 miles, and I think you can do better than that. John's my name, and I'm an alcoholic. Couple of qualifications. I am a past delegate, but someone said out of state, it was out of the country in Australia. We weren't 61 or 47, we were Area B. You know, that's how many areas we've got. We follow the structure to a certain extent. It's tremendous to be here. The other qualification is an apology or a tenth step before we get going. Says at the end of the day, if you're a fan. I looked at that tonight, you know, and I thought, I haven't had a bad day, and then someone got up here and talked about taking photos. So I've taken a couple of the photos here, and my apologies. It was mainly to show the facilities back home. One of the guys I sponsor, Lenny from Morissette, puts a weekend like this on every year. He doesn't get the committee. He is the committee. He'll be getting a copy of this tape, too. And I just wanted to show him some of the facilities and hope that some of them will come over as a result of our visit with you. And so my apologies. I did look at... we are very conscious of no photos in the meetings. I wasn't aware there was no photos for the weekend. We normally just don't take a camera, but we're on a tour. And so I'm sure that when we get those photos developed, if any of you look too... visible, we'll either get it blurred out or destroy the photos, and that's the deal. Now, I was given a badge of America here, and I had the badge of Australia, and this flower is growing up over it, and the state hospitality badge for Minneapolis is crowding out the Australian thing. So what I did do was bring along a little... Now, the reason for that, I'm involved with the hospitality room in Minneapolis for Australia, and I've got a bigger Australian flag to go in our hospitality room and that. But there is something between this flag and that flag there. Recently, a well-known American said that he was talking in the last century, he said that Australia has always, of all the countries in the world, Australia has always been in America in any conflict. Every conflict that America's been in, we've been there with you. And I was thinking about that today. I think that deserves a clap if nothing else does. Those sort of conflicts are a bit like alcoholism, you know. That's the importance of our traditions, that our common welfare comes first. And that's what brings this sort of night together to a, you know, fitting climax for such a wonderful weekend. And it can't be described, it's got to be lived. And that conflict of what this particular leading American was talking about, he was talking about conflicts of nations and conflicts of difference between nations and that sort of thing. But here, worldwide, we have a common bond. We have a common sort of basis. We lived in Singapore for some time, and there was a guy there called Mok. Mok was a little Chinese who couldn't speak English. And when we'd get to how it works that we've just shared, Mok would pull out a battered piece of paper that had the how it works in Chinese, and he would read that to himself. And I said to a guy there one night, I said, you talk the same dialect as Mok, don't you? And he said, yes, I do. I said, why don't you get Mok to tell you his story and then you tell it to us? And he did. And the only difference was that Mok, who was a seaman, had been locked up in jails in the Northern Hemisphere, and we'd been locked up in jails in the Southern Hemisphere, you know? And many other similarities. And that's why Bill called it a language of the heart. And today's reading from, I'm going to read is a little extract from today's Daily Reflections. And I thought for a minute I was in California with all that levity that we're having when we had, you know, to convey the importance of this program. And it's tremendous. It says there, why shouldn't we laugh? But be mindful of what it says we are. It says in today's reading, June 24, a spiritual kindergarten. We are only operating a spiritual kindergarten in which people are enabled to get over drinking and find the grace to go on living to better effect. And isn't that tremendous? If I keep in mind, or as Bill Wilson died with the divine dissatisfaction of still more yet to be done. More yet to be done about himself, and more yet to be done about the fellowship and for the fellowship. And I'm of the same, and I take great stock in that. You know, I was in San Diego 5 years ago, and I hope I've told my wife this before because she wasn't there. And during one of the breaks, I had just had a bypass a couple of years before, and it was similar temperature to this, perhaps even a bit hotter. And I wasn't in any better physical condition than I am now. But in between meetings and that, they had a South American band there, and they had all these people jazzing around, and there was this lovely young Negro dancer there in tights and that, and she must have thought this old so-and-so from Australia will embarrass him, you know. And she called me into the middle of the dance, and I got in there, and I'm doing this South American dance, you know, and the rest of all these youngies stopped because I was giving them such a treat, you know. In fact, the band wanted me to go back to South America with them as part of the... But they didn't know that when I got off the stage, I went out the back and nearly collapsed, you know. I thought it'd be nice if the message gets back to my wife in Australia. Died while doing the South American rumba. So we're in this spiritual kindergarten. Or I am. And I got a lot of insight into it in the last couple of weeks. I've been to a lot of meetings over here where people identified by growing up in the 60s, and there was a few people grew up in the 70s, and they talked about the Vietnam War and, you know, the hippie era and the first cultivation of marijuana and all that sort of stuff. And then all of a sudden they seemed to have grown up. And I thought, geez, I'm a slow learner. I grew up in the 40s and the 50s and the 60s and the 70s and the 80s and the 90s. Must be in about the year 2010 I'll start to get that maturity that says, you know, you shouldn't enjoy it when you go to Soberfest and Jamie gets up here and Diana's, you know, carrying around and all that sort of thing. And, you know, I can remember the first time we experienced in the Mexican wave, I think, was in Seattle or Montreal. And Carmen, my wife, was there, and a couple of other girls that she sponsored in Al-Anon, and there were a couple of us more sedate alcoholics, didn't want to be embarrassed in sobriety by these Al-Anons. And the first couple of times the American wave went around those superdomes, you know, sit down, you're embarrassing me, you know. But by the end of it, we're all up, you know, and that's the spirit that's here. And that was the spirit that we just shared when people were reading how it works and that. I think it's been tremendous in that era, you know, to recognise that why shouldn't we laugh? We have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. I come from a town which is pretty much in the middle of Australia, a place called Broken Hill. It's a mining town. My father was a miner. But it was a very strong union town, a very strong Catholic town. And between the two of them, we had a pretty good life. You know, what the church didn't tell us to do, the unions told the bosses what to do. And we had a fairly regimented, tough, you know, tough in a mining town, a lot of boozing and a lot of, or a good number of accidents with the mines and things like that, and a few suicides from the booze and all that sort of thing. But generally, there was a fair bit of stability. My father drank a fair bit, but he was never missed work through the booze, and there was a great solidarity between the workers. They worked in underground in what we called stopes, which were about half the size of this, and they worked together, you know, 7 or 8 hours a day, 5 days a week, for year in, year out, you know. So they had to put up with each other. Their lives depended on each other, and they worked a type of contract basis, so the money that they earned depended on each other. And so I came from that background, and so I came also with the conscience of coming from that background and with a Catholic background, and the things that, you know, came to mind in relation to the conditioning of that was we were in Akron the other week, and they had 3 old timers at the old timers panel, and between them, am I talking too fast, or you can all understand me or not? Anyhow, that's good. But you can also buy the tape afterwards and run it on slow speed. Anyhow, I said to Dick, who is involved with Reggie in that tape library, Dick was where we were last week, and he's talking about tape and my talk here and that. I said, I don't think you'll sell too many. He said, I think we'll give them away. I thought, thanks for the confidence. But anyhow, we were in Akron the other week, and we had these 3 old-timers, 2 men and 1 woman. With between the 3 of them, they had 160 years sobriety. And one of the, well, they all knew Bill and Bob and all that sort of thing. There weren't many members around that long ago. Anyhow, one of them was talking about Clarence Snyder, and Clarence Snyder, who was the last of the first 100 to die, who was the brewmaster in the Big Book. And he told the story about when Clarence came up from Cleveland one Wednesday night with his crew and told them at the Oxford group that they weren't coming back anymore. And, you know, Bob and the rest of the Oxford group team were a bit aghast at that. And Clarence said, no, he said, we've got too many Catholics in our show now, and the Catholic Church of those days wouldn't allow Catholics to associate with any other spiritual or religious belief, he said. And that's so I don't know whether you get the insight from me passing that on second hand, but I thought that was tremendous that Clarence got that insight, because I was in that era where we used to go home from the Catholic school and peek into other churches to see if the devil lived in there, because that was the belief that we'd been given, you know, or that was the suspicion that. And I'm not knocking I don't knock anything. You know, this is a spiritual program. There's no competition in the spiritual world. My sponsor said, don't knock anything here. Could be the rock you perish on. He said, the thing that you're going to knock, do you know, is knock a word here? Point the finger at, criticise sort of thing. Never seen a statue ever to a critic. You know, seen some great statues around the world to people who've done things, but never seen a statue to a critic. So I try not to criticise. I try not to. Doesn't mean I don't. I just try not to. And anyhow, the insight that that gave me the other week was things like when I was an altar boy at 14 and living in a town that was well away from the from where the vineyards were, and well away from Vatican in Rome. I'll give you the tip, we're a long way from Rome. And so we didn't get blessed wine. So what we used to do is get the wine from the local wine saloon, Della Valley's Wine Saloon it was called. And the priest, who was also an alcoholic, liked to have the last of the wine before it was blessed in the bottle, you know. And then he would send us down to Della Valley's to get it topped up. And Della Valley's would pull it out of a keg. So there was no measure on how much went in the bottle. So what we would do on the way down to Della Valley's, we'd grab the bottles before they were empty, and we'd say to the priest, do you want us to go and get some more altar wine? Well, I was the altar boy that altered. But it didn't stop with the altar wine, because I became a regular at Della Valley's. Now, our legal drinking age was and is still 18. And I was in there. I celebrated a football premiership that we won, an under-15 football premiership in Della Valley's Wine Saloon. And we were propping up kids who were flat out seen over the bar on these high stools, you know, and telling them not to say anything because they might, because they hadn't, their voice hadn't broken. I think someone mentioned at the age of puberty or something here last night. Their voice hadn't broken, so we said, don't you give the game up. We don't want anyone who hasn't reached that squeaky voice stage starting to talk here and give us up. So that was bad enough. Then the next experience was of the brothers and the priests fighting over which order I was going to go into, whether I'd become a brother or a priest. I hadn't had much say in it, but, you know, they thought, here's this fine, upstanding young Catholic boy. We'll claim him as one of ours, the brother said, and the priest said, no, you won't. We want him. Well, they had a movie on, talk about the solidarity of Broken Hill getting into trouble and Della Valley's Wine Saloon getting into trouble. They had this movie on called Our Lady of Lourdes, which was in a local public picture theatre but run by the nuns. Now, I had been down to Della Valley's Wine Saloon before the show went on and got a big Coke bottle full of wine. So I'm in the picture theatre, and being Broken Hill where you shared everything, a bit like Alcoholics Anonymous, the two guys either side of me said, John, give us a swiggy of Coke. No, you know, there's more than Coke in this one. Anyhow, they kept insisting. This is during the war, just after the war I'm talking about, where we used to even share our chewing gum. Did anyone do that here, where you'd have a bit of chewing gum? It'll date you if you tell me, because chewing gum was real short, even in America. We used to love it when the American servicemen had come into Australia, and we'd get our chewing gum replenished. But when we had it rationed, you'd get a half a PK, and you'd chew it for a while, and then you'd give it to your mate. That's how much we had to share. Things were tough. Anyhow. Anyhow. I keep an eye on Charlie here. Charlie said he'll sit in the front row, so if I want to have a shot at any American jokes, he can take the brunt of it. Because he said to me, he said, you from down under? I said, yeah. He said, I know. He said, the amazing thing is that we think so what, you know. So that's the importance of our allied relationship with Americans, when you've got people like Charlie who don't even care if we are down under. Anyhow, talking about down under, the one of the first conventions we came to in America, there was a psychiatrist, a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, from Alabama there, and, you know, hardly anyone had moved out of Australia, but Carmen and I were there on this trip, and we went to this small place not far from here in Massachusetts, and the chair people were that excited, they rushed up and wanted to introduce us to the speaker after the meeting, and he came from Alabama, you know, which is a long way south, nearly as far as Australia south. Anyhow, they were all that excited, and you know, here's the speaker, and here's these two visitors, and, you know, boy, what a convention we got with the psychiatrist from Alabama and two people from Australia, you know. It's really getting top heavy. Anyhow, they introduced us to him, and he said, "Australia, where's Australia?" Well, I'd had enough of Americans saying, "Where's Australia?" by now, you know. I said, "South of Alabama." And peace to anyone from the South. That's just a true story, not a shot at the South, you know. So anyhow, time moved on, as you would hope. I'm starting to move on, you know. I'm starting to run out of time. We haven't started. It's a bit like with a convention like this in Australia once, and a couple of the old hands were there, and there was a bloke sitting next to where Charlie's sitting, and the guy started to doze off, but he didn't stop dozing off. He started snoring. Anyhow, this old hand Bob from Melbourne said to the guy where Charlie's sitting, he said, "Hey, wake him up, he's distracting me from me talk." He said, "You wake him up, you put him to sleep." So I went through national service. I forget which war that was, the Korean War or the Vietnam War, around that era sort of thing, and I went in a private and came out a private. The only thing there was that we weren't allowed to drink. I don't know whether it was like here at the time, but we weren't allowed to drink in national service. It was called national service, compulsory military training and that. But what the officers and sergeants that used to do, if they ever wanted to have a sly party, it was me they asked to organise it, you know. They had me in the caboose as often as anyone else in that intake. But when it came to having a little bit of things that you shouldn't have, they knew who could organise it. And my life was a bit like that, you know, that and one of the conditionings in Broken Hill, and I hope this tape doesn't go back there, but one of the conditionings there was, on the mines, you think they've got some security around here, it wasn't so much stealing from the mines was the problem, it was getting it past the security guards. If you got it past the security guards, it was virtually yours. In fact, the security guards would ask you how you got it past them so as they could do it themselves, you know, to get stuff off the mine. Well, with that sort of conditioning, you know, I was a sitter for doing the wrong thing. And when I was doing the wrong thing, it was not so much 10-step stuff then. It was when I got caught, what did I do wrong this time that I won't do wrong the next time so as I don't get caught? It was never mind not do it. It was do it without getting caught was the secret. Now, you take that into the workplace, and I got a brother who was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous till he died a few years ago, and another brother who drank with us, and we caused a fair bit of trouble. You know, not running around shooting people, although we'd been threatened to be shot and all sorts of things, but we had one night there where Clive, who come and knows, fortunately, unfortunately, he's a guy that's been in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous longer than anyone I know and continues to drink and still alive, you know. Amazing. He came to Alcoholics Anonymous in the late 50s and still alive and still, you know, able to survive. But we were there one night and someone busted into the hotel we were staying in. We'd been flown up down the town, and the publican had a shotgun and his wife had a 45, you know, and Clive was the person that they were aiming it at, you know, and the publican's wife was saying, "Go on, shoot him, shoot him." And I said, "Yeah, go on, shoot him and see what happens to you." You know, well, the room was that small, a lot of us would have been gone. So, you know, those sort of situations, looking back at, were, you know, accidents. Carat come and shared this afternoon about me riding off two cars in the last month of my drinking and that sort of thing. But the deterioration was dramatic. The year before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, the company, or the Easter before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, the company I worked for were going to give us a trip around the world. And then in about the October, that was Easter, and about the October of that year, which I think was 71, I'd collapsed in the foyer. I worked for one of the biggest construction companies in Australia at the time, and I collapsed in the foyer of this company. And just after lunch, I'd had a liquid lunch, and the company secretary and the finance officer drove me home and poured me into the lounge room and said to Carmen, we think your husband got a drinking problem. She rolled her eyes, and, you know, she knew by that stage, that she'd known for quite some time there was a drinking problem. And she rang, we parted company with that company. I'd written off one of their cars and one of our own cars just in that period. And I gracefully resigned. Like, they had my letter of dismissal written at the same time. It was, you know, there was no plea either way as to what was going to happen. It was the end of the story. And I was thinking about it. Someone was talking here within the last day or so about some of the horrific conditions that I got into in that period, and yet the grace of God, you know, just right out of my head, driving cars. And and we had a gravel driveway, and Carmen had hear me come in the drive, and sometimes she'd leave me in the car, and it was real, not snow country, but as cold as it gets in Australia, gets down to freezing in this particular area. Sometimes she'd leave me in the car, sometimes she'd open the door and I'd fall out on the gravel, and, you know, and I was 18 stone or something. I don't know how much that is in pounds, but it was a lot of weight. 14 by 18 gives you the pounds. But, you know, so there was that sort of thing, and there were three young children. Not a pleasant place to be. I'd been locked up a few times for drunken driving, not charged with drunken driving, but, you know, police would take the keys off me and put them behind the bar and all that sort of thing. And it was a pretty bad state to be in within a matter of months. My brother at the time had the shakes, and he was drinking fairly heavily, and I thought it was the stress from him that was on me. And at the same time, I was building a number of major public facilities, like high schools, like university facilities, and dealing with government architects, government departmental representatives. When I went back to make amends to some of those people, they thought that the person they'd seen before, that was natural. They had never seen me sober. You know, they thought that's just the way I was. And I would go to the country with some of that work, up in the woods or the bush or whatever you want to call it, out of town, out of the bigger cities. And when I was in the city, I'd have a secretary to take the minutes from the meetings and that sort of thing. And when I'd go to the country, I'd have to take the minutes myself. And I'd send those minutes into these government architects and that at times, and they'd send them back and say, these are the wrong minutes, these must have been from another project, you know. This is not the project you were dealing with us on. And I think, my God, what do I do now, you know? And so there was a dramatic deterioration. And at about that time, we separated, or I shot through and went to Sydney, and Carmen and the kids were living in Melbourne. And then Carmen, through a series of circumstances that she shared here this afternoon, where she remembered her uncle, who had been in the first group of Alcoholics Anonymous in Australia when it first started in Australia in 1945. Australia was the first place outside of North America to have Alcoholics Anonymous in it. My sponsor, who's still alive today, he's 86 and 46 years sober. His sponsor was a guy called Skinny Bob, who was sponsored by Father Michael, who was the first priest to get sober in Australia, who was sponsored by Dr. Minogue. Dr. Minogue wrote to headquarters in New York in 1942. And Bobby, who was the secretary to Bill and Bill Wilson, Bobby and Bill Wilson sponsored Dr. Minogue. So I can trace back the continuity of the people that are in the line of sponsorship, if you like, that I'm involved with, and they've all been extremely active members. But anyhow, Carmen remembered this Uncle Russ in the first group of Alcoholics Anonymous that she shared about this afternoon. And she rang Alcoholics Anonymous, and they said, we can't help your husband, but there is a fellowship that can help you called Al-Anon. She rang Al-Anon, and she went to her first meeting of Al-Anon on the 17th of September 1971, and she's been at least at one meeting of Al-Anon every week since. In fact, when she had a stay in hospital at one stage through an injury she had, there was meetings of Al-Anon taken into the hospital. to maintain that continuity. So if it wasn't for Al-Anon, I wouldn't be here. I was 12 steps from my wife. We were separated, as I said. I rang her up one night, and she said, "You can come home if you don't drink and go to Alcoholics Anonymous." My first reaction was, I wonder where I can find a psychiatrist who can explain that to me, you know? I don't think it needs any explanation. You can come home if you don't drink and go to Alcoholics Anonymous. Pretty simple. Not easy to achieve. I was staying at a place called Naval House in Sydney, which is where the Matlows, do you call the Matlows over here, Charlie? Seamen? Anyhow, I'd been on the local ferry, which is about a 7 mile ride, and that's about as far as I've ever been the ferry. Anyhow, but they used to have beds at this place for 5 shillings, which is about half a dollar, 2 quarters. And they used to have tax-free booze. Well, when I went to Sydney in my drinking days, I quickly became a seaman. And I'd, you know, get the gate going in there, and anyhow, I'm in there this night, and I ring Carmen in Melbourne, and she said, "You're going to Alcoholics Anonymous," and I righto. So I announced it to the bar. I said, "This is my last night on the booze. I'm going back to Melbourne on the train when you close, and I'm going to Alcoholics Anonymous." Well, you could have heard a pin drop. And then all of a sudden, as good seamen would do, they realised they were losing one of their comrades. So if you... No, I did not suggest that. I was going to say, if you're ever on a relapse, that's where you go. But, you know, they put the booze on free for me for the rest of the night. Like they opened the bar for me. They said, yeah, it was like a wake. And I couldn't get enough into me. Like, yeah, another one for Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. And they all loved it because they just opened the bar. Like, it was a semi-government sort of, run by the Navy, semi-government sort of thing. So, you know, everyone, the bar was drinking free booze because this guy's going to Alcoholics Anonymous. Just think of that, you know, just think of that as the insanity of that, like, you know. I'd seen my brother, my sponsor, when my brother used to, you know, it took him a long time to get sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, and when he would be in hospital, they'd call my sponsor, Broken Hill Jack, who came from Broken Hill also, he'd be one side of the bed, and we the family would be the other side of the bed, and we'd see the recovery that was in Broken Hill Jack, because I drank with him in Broken Hill years before. I'd seen the change in his life. And I saw the deterioration in my brother's life. And yet here I was playing with my own life. You know? And that's the insanity of the disease. In fact, to a great extent, my recovery started from the second step. To see what I had done to myself and my family and my children and my health and all the other issues in life, the opportunities lost, you know, I'd had some enormous good business opportunities and that sort of thing. And to see the deterioration as a result of this, I had to be insane. And taking it back to my mother, it started with my mother, it was with my wife, she knew there was love in my heart, but I couldn't express it. My mother, I was laying I used to rush back to Broken Hill at times before I was married to retreat and lick my wounds and that sort of thing. And I was laying in bed there one morning and I heard my mother talking to this Catholic priest. And there was a photo of me at about 17 years of age on the mantelpiece. And I heard this priest say to my mother, "Isn't he a lovely young fella? It's a pity he drinks so much," you know? Not a good thing to hear a conversation between a priest and your mother at 17 and to live with that sort of thing, you know? Not a good thing to wake up out of a blackout with my mother-in-law, who was one of my best friends until she died a few years ago at 96 years of age, went to Al-Anon for as long as she could, and was a great supporter of the fellowship because she seen what I'd done. Because the only hostility I ever seen in that woman in her life, Carmen had a fairly major operation, and Ivy, my mother-in-law, had come to help us look after the kids and that while Carmen was recovering. And I remember coming out of a blackout and her saying to me, "If you don't smarten yourself up, I'm leaving here and you'll be left with the consequences." And that stays with me. You know, even though I made amends, you know, to turn a loving, caring, compassionate, passive sort of a woman into that sort of rage, you know, is not a good thing for a disease. I heard one of the other Al-Anons today talking about, you know, the disease, you know, and the way it treated someone, and I'm not going to go into their story, but I understood where they were coming from. And so I started going to Alcoholics Anonymous. I was unemployed and unemployable and, as I said, separated. I'd been given 6 months to live. A doctor looked at my liver. He said, you know, you continue to drink and you'll be dead in 6 months. And the amazing thing is that the liver, caught at that stage, is one of the few organs in the body that can self-recover itself, you know. And but it can be an awful scare. So we're at a meeting in the early days, and there was a couple there called Martin and Nancy. Martin and Nancy, and Nancy said to me, she was one of those really tough Al-Anon women, and she said, "What brought you here?" And I said, "I've given 6 months to live with me liver." She said, "Fear alone won't get you sober." And her husband, who had many years up at that stage, said, "No, but it's a good starter, you know." My sponsor said, "Don't care how they get here." You know, I've heard people say, "No use coming here to get the police off your back." I did, and they do. Stay off my back. "No use coming here to get your family back." I did. They came back. And I'm not saying this happens to everyone, you know. But the circumstances under which one has to get here are the circumstances. Whatever the circumstances, if we're here, my sponsor says, at some of the meetings, and I haven't struck it heavily here, but some of the meetings I go to, they hold hands at the end when they say the Serenity Prayer, the Lord's Prayer, and then they say, "Keep coming back." My sponsor says, "If you don't go away, you don't have to worry about getting back." You know? And if I'm in here, I'm not out there wondering how the hell I'm going to get back in here. If everyone that thought they had another chance out there was, you know, back in here, there wouldn't be a facility in Connecticut that would hold this weekend, if it's my experience, or talking where I come from. We've got a big opera house there that wouldn't hold our local meetings if everyone that thought they had another chance. I've seen some awful tragedies, and I'm not here to belabor the tragedy of this disease, but we never ever want to forget it. We never ever want to forget the tragedy of this disease and the enjoyment of sobriety and the power of the enjoyment of sobriety that we're experiencing here this weekend is to set the example. I was sharing with someone last night, if you brought a newcomer to a place like this, there is very, very little show that they'd ever have another drink if they were alcoholic of the defeated type that I was, because, you know, I've heard people say when you go to a doom and gloom meeting, they call them out here. Do you have doom and gloom meetings here? And someone say, "If you want what we've got, will we go to any lengths to get it?" No thanks, don't want that. But it'd be hard to be here. What else could you ask for on this weekend? If you're not happy with this weekend, you're going to have trouble in paradise. You know? I mean, this is the next thing. They're not a fault in the weather, the temperature, the water, the food, the committee. You know, it's just an enormous. The people that run the place. I had to ask, were they alcoholics? They were fitting in so well with what we wanted. My sponsor said, he said, when we get sober and start working that program, he said, we go for a job interview. He said, they don't interview us. We interview them to see if they're good enough for us to work with. When we come to these places, Bob says, I better fit in with these alcoholics. Do you know, I'm talking about America, but I'm sure some of you know about it. Do you know that in America, Alcoholics Anonymous is the biggest user of hotel rooms of any one organisation in America? Amazing. We do a lot of fun, don't we? Right? The American Hotels Association seems to like it. We don't even burn the bedside tables anymore because they won't even let you smoke there anymore. We don't puke over the pillars and take all the towels when we're going. just in case. I don't know what just in case, well, we wouldn't think they're having a shower. They're just handy as souvenirs. One of our old hands back home said, when you're doing that inventory and you've borrowed a few towels from the hotel, don't write souvenirs, put stealing. You know, if you do something without permission of the owner, it's stealing. That's just how simple the old hands were where I came from, you know. My sponsor, Broken Hill Jack, never been christened, didn't know the Lord's Prayer. He sponsored judges, nuns, leaders of industry, all sorts of people. Because he said things like this to me. He said, use that serenity prayer like your right arm. He said, talk it. He said, and if you think people who think you're crazy, he said, stand on a busy corner in the middle of Hartford, if we're in Connecticut, and count the number of people going past who aren't talking to themselves. Because everyone's got, I heard someone saying, issues, you know. I was at a meeting the other day in another state and someone said, I got to go to this type of meeting because I've got issues I want to talk about. And their sponsor said, you've got alcoholism, we're going to do it through those steps. And it says in there, you know, at the end of Dr. Bob's story, it says, if we go about, this is an American word, zeal, Charlie, zeal. If we go about this with half the zeal we went about our drinking, our Heavenly Father will never let us down. Well, I'll give you the tip. It wasn't zeal I had, unless we've got a different understanding to the Americans to what zeal is. You know, I went around it with great gusto. I could go into a town that I'd never been into before at 2 o'clock in the morning and find somewhere to get a drink. And we were put off a train there once. We were playing up on a train. Talk about snow country. I'd never seen snow before, and we're working in an area where up in the Snowies, which is a hydroelectric scheme, and we'd been waiting for the snow. And we're in this boozer this night, drinking away, and the first snowfall of the season came. We were on the train out the next day, gave up the jobs, away we went, but we took a big cargo of booze with us. And they put us off in this little town because we were disrupting the train, and we had the guard on the train drunk and the porter was drunk, everyone was drunk. And they wouldn't let us off the station, the railway station, because the police didn't want us in the town, the railway didn't want us back, so we're no man's land. At about 2 o'clock in the morning, that Clive that I mentioned before that's still drinking, Clive decided we'd run out of booze, so he decided to break the curfew and went up the town. And I thought he'll get locked up. He didn't get locked up. He brought the policeman back, that brought the next load of booze back in the police vehicle. And so he was into the booze as well. Another time we were locked up and with the same trip, further along. And the policeman got drunk with us and forgot to lock the jail that we're in. So his wife, the police lived with his family on the thing there, on the police station, and his wife chased us up the street. And the policeman's chasing, he wanted to bail. Like, he didn't care whether he stayed or went, but he wanted to bail. So that's going back in history when we were moving forward, but that's the way I am. So we come to Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm about 3 months sober, and I was offered a job in Darwin, which is right at the top of Australia, right at the very top point, but it's a very hot part. It's the hottest part of it. It's 30, it's 88. It's about this temperature all year round. But it was also at the time the per capita, the drinking capital of the world. They drank more booze per man, woman and child there than anywhere else in the world. Here I am about 3 months sober. And, you know, time doesn't permit to go into what sort of gear we had and how many cases and all that. But it was a good job and a big job, you know, and we started to do well. But there was only 3 meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous a week there.
This is the end of side 1. Please turn cassette over now and continue to listen on side 2. Do not fast forward.
Al-Anon and only one other AA member regular sober. We sometimes had 20 odd people at a meeting, so you could work out what condition the others were in, you know. And there was Paul, who was a German, or still, he's still sober. He was going to come to Minneapolis, but I got a an email the other day that he's taken sick and he can't make it, but he's 40-odd years sober and getting on in years and not well. But anyhow, Paul was there and he couldn't read and write English too well because of his German background. And he was the secretary of these three meetings. And he said to me, he said, you better become secretary of one of these meetings. I said, they told me in Sydney you had to be 6 months sober before you could be any sort of involvement in service. He said, if you want to stay sober, you better become secretary of one of these groups. So I did. And anyhow, Carmen went and learnt Indonesian cooking, Asian cooking, you know, and we were the only couple there for a start. And so all the alcoholics would land there. Uninvited Thursday night was Indonesian cooking night, you know, and they'd all land there. Bear in mind, you know, I'm sober less than most people in this room, and I've got this big job with this big company and car and phone and people mowing me lawn and, you know, all sorts of things. And one of the things was a company phone. So thank God for the insanity of early sobriety, but being conscripted to service, because I put the company phone number in the local newspaper three times a week as the Alcoholics Anonymous contact. Talk about early sobriety. I'll tell you what, you know, that looks sane. For years, some of those early actions looked sane. And Carmen decided she'd put an ad in the paper, Al-Anon, you know, so the local Catholic school where our kids were going, we had the room for the Alcoholics Anonymous, and Carmen used to sit in the room next door, and she'd have this ad in the paper and pray for someone to come along, and eventually she got Al-Anon going, and the first woman she 12-stepped in Al-Anon there, or one of the first women, ended up becoming the Alateen coordinator for Australia, and her husband ended up sober and been sober a lot of years now. But then we moved a few times and we moved back to Sydney, and I was talking to Bob and Hugh over the last day or so about a guy called Wesley Parrish. We were at a convention in Canberra in 1978, and a guy called Wesley Parrish came out there, and he was a big book student, if you like, and he put the initial stuff together that some of you would be familiar about with Charlie and Joe and those sort of things today. And anyhow, Wesley and the guy that was with him, Wayne P. from Kansas, stayed with us for a couple of weeks. And the first book study in Australia was held in our lounge room. And Wesley said, you know, where would you like to start in this? I said, oh, let's have a look at the four step, you know, as a run-through. But at the end of the night, I said, I think we'd better go back to the beginning of the book, you know. And the number of times I've been through that book since, I couldn't say. The number of fourth and fifth steps, I couldn't say. I don't count them. Probably average about every 2 years a fourth and fifth step. But time moved on, and time's moving on here. But we've been very active. We found that it says in there, to see a fellowship grow up about you, to have a host of friends. This is not heroic stuff. I've been on the dole twice in sobriety. We had a recession that our Prime Minister said down there we needed to have. I don't necessarily agree with him. I think we could have done without that recession quite handsomely. And this is only a few years ago, and I was in my, you know, late 50s sort of thing, and I thought, oh, I'm doomed to, you know, the scrap heap and that sort of thing. And in 1972, I'd been given 6 months to live through this disease. In 1982, we went to Singapore to live, and as a result of that, the family had to have medicals for our insurance, medical insurance. And when the results came back, the doctor who was our local family doctor, in fact, we lived in one of their houses at one stage, we were that close, you know, friend relationship with them. And he said to me, when the other part of the rest of the family, Carmen and the girls, had gone out, he said, I need to talk to you. And I said, what's wrong? He said, the last time I seen anyone with lungs like yours, they were dead in 6 months. They found that I had asbestos from working in the power stations and that sort of thing. And he said, but you might as well go to Singapore and die and enjoy yourself in the meantime. I said, oh, thanks for your bedside manners. But anyhow, that's 82, and he said 6 months, and that's a fair while ago. And then in 92, I had a triple bypass, and that's getting on a bit. And a couple of years ago, I was diagnosed with a secondary melanoma. But I believe, you know, that it's in God's way and God's time that life continues on. Having a reasonable level of success through God's grace and solely through God's ways in our lives and through Carmen's, I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for my wife's active. In fact, it concerns me at times, you know, that I know that God and I alone just couldn't do it. You know, you may disagree with that. I know that I need the support. My sponsor says AA, Al-Anon and Alateen working together are not to tear families apart, they're to put it back. That doesn't mean there aren't exceptions where it's impossible to live in situations and all the other issues. That I don't get into that. I'm just saying that where possible, the grace of God has worked in our lives. We've had to use those steps. When our kids were in Alateen, we had to have family group consciences. We had to allow those kids, particularly when they got 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, you know, they got to an age of reasoning, they got to an age of understanding, they got to an age to know when we're trying to put it over them, when we're trying to not stick to our role on the to wash up and lead by example and all the other things that parents think they at times can con kids, and it's not on. You can't con kids. You know, and I might think I can by dictatorial and verbose. I can remember my kids saying to me, "Dad, you're shouting." You know, "No, I'm not." "Dad, you're raising your voice." "No, I'm not." And then eventually through this program, I thought, if that's how they see it, that's how they see it. You know, and I had to accept. And I've got two granddaughters now, I was just talking to our daughters and one of our granddaughters within the last few hours before we came in here, and one of them has been, as Carmen shared this afternoon, dramatically affected by her father, who was a member of this fellowship and drank within the last few weeks after 9 years of sobriety, who abandoned my daughter and his children at Christmas time. And I kept saying to him, he just got made a state manager for a big company, and he started to drink success like wine, and, you know, missing his meetings and not ringing his sponsor, who I know, and all that stuff, and, you know, and eventually, but to see the effect on those two children. In fact, that Dr. Minogue that I mentioned, that was one of the founders of Alcoholics Anonymous in Australia, was the most preeminent medico in Australia at the time in the treatment of alcoholism. And he said he could tell whether a child was predisposed to being an alcoholic at 5 or 6 years of age. You know, and we see that, not necessarily that they're alcoholic, these children, but to see the effect of this disease on them, and that slight edge of nervousness in that youngest one, who will trust you with anything if you don't, you know, if you keep a continuity of your voice. And that, and that's where it talks about you know, dressing becomingly and behaving appropriately and enjoying the. I was telling some of the people asked where we came from. It's a little town called Watanabe, which means a quiet place with nature. And I said to a couple of people just before the meeting, I said, this is a bit like the Watanabe of Connecticut, you know, where we're so quiet with nature, and yet we can have that little bit of levity before the meeting, and, you know, all the things that go to make up the things that were impossible for me as an active alcoholic. I don't know whether they use the term here, practice an alcoholic. One of the rare things that I didn't have to practice at in my life was being an active alcoholic. It required no practice whatsoever. There was a little bit of practice at keeping it down initially, you know. But I twigged to that. I'd have a few beers, and up they'd come, and then I'd get the hard stuff down because that was more expensive and I'd prefer to keep that down. But, you know, one of our older members back home said, it takes a steady hand to hold a full cup. And God will only give us what I can hold in the cup in that moment, in that day, in that hour, in relation to the needs. My spiritual advisor called into my office there once on a big project, smelter, aluminium smelter. And I was busy, 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 you know, and go, you know, and 30-odd management people working for me, and there are plenty of people to take the busyness out of my life if I so choose to delegate. And I was told by a mate of mine, he's dead now, he said, you're a great bloke and a great boss, but a poor delegator. I said, well, you're the first. You know, and that's the tremendous thing of delegation in Alcoholics Anonymous, where the servants serve, you know. They're not the bosses. And to see the servants on this weekend serve and not just telling people what to do. Anyhow, the spiritual advisor said to me, he said, he could see I was, you know, agitated and irritable, restless, discontented with him being there, to be honest. Anyhow, he said to me, he said, do you know the most important person in your life today? He said, not your boss over the passageway. Not your family at home. He said, it's me. He said, I'm in front of you and give me your attention. And he's right. I didn't like it at the time. When I first came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I heard someone share it today here, they'd say to me, be out on the footpath. And my sponsor and a couple of other guys that were in our team, you know, they'd take it in turns of picking up, or my sponsor would be tied up and he'd meet us at the meeting, so he'd get someone else to pick me up, and that we had no car, we'd written them off and that, so I had to rely on other people. And he said, be on the footpath tomorrow night at 7 o'clock. We're going across town, it's 8 o'clock meeting, we're going to have to travel a bit further, be there. And they'd take off. I'd stand on the footpath, I think. I didn't even say I was going tomorrow night. And then I think, come to think of it, they didn't ask me. And then I thought, there's some giving going on here and some receiving. And I've got nothing to give. Now, for a person, my sponsor said to me when I first came here, he said, are you a person that can be told what to do? Thank God there was a lie or two left in me. I said, yes. I'd never been told what to do in my life. Yes, I'll do it. Yes, yes. Does anyone know what a contrary Lincoln is? Did they ever use that term here? It's more of a pommy English term, I think. Contrary Lincoln was someone that always did the opposite to what was expected. My mother, who loved me, called me a contrary Lincoln at about 5 or 7 years of age. Always doing the opposite. In fact, they call it reverse psychology in politically correct terms today, you know? Tell them to do the opposite and a good chance they'll do the right thing. Now, so here was these people from all walks of life, people who would normally not mix, going out of their way. And then Jack Brogenhill, Jack, my sponsor, would say, now tomorrow night, before I pick you up, I'm going to pick Ronnie up. Now, Ronnie was fairly new, sober too. And he'd say, Ronnie's been down to St. Vincent de Paul today and bought a new about four owners previously, bought a new white shirt for 50 cents. And you be sure, when you get in the car, when we pick you up, you tell him how smart he looks tonight. And I get in the car and I think, there's Ronnie, hasn't got the proper haircut, talks with a bit of a Westie. David Westie's here. Anyhow, people from the boonies or whatever. Anyhow, and he had this shirt on that I knew wasn't new, but it was immaculate. And Ronnie be sitting there, and I'd have to say, gee, Ronnie, you look smart tonight. And you can see his chest go out. And I got what my sponsor told me at my first meeting. I said to him after my first meeting, I said, you know, Jack, I said, I feel different. He said, you probably would, son. I said, why is that? He said, you've probably gone the first time in your adult life that you've gone an hour and a half without thinking about your worst problem. I said, what's that? He said, you. He said, when you're listening with an open mind and you're thinking kind thoughts of the speaker and not how quick can we get out of here and how much longer is that bonehead from Australia going to go on, when you're thinking like that, you're still thinking of yourself. My brother, who was a member of this fellowship till he died, he said, self-centred people don't necessarily think highly of themselves, but only of themselves. So my sponsor said, he said, when you're thinking and you're listening kindly to the speakers, and when you're working through the steps with your sponsor and knowing that they're doing it for your good as much as for their own good, you start to get what we call mental diversion, where you get your mind off yourself. Because God can't come in while you're full of self. God doesn't like competition, and if you're in competition with God, God will let you run your own race for as long as you like. And you will go through more pain. As Carmen said today, things got worse before they got better. And there have been plenty of times in our sobriety. And she shared about our first convention. Since we've been sober, we've been to every national and international convention that we've been able to get to. And the first one was in Adelaide, where she described where her mother, who was on a pension, wrote her a letter, and in the letter was a cheque for $2,000, and we'd been out and we didn't have the money for petrol, let alone, you know, to go there and get accommodation. Carmen kept saying, have faith of a mustard seed, you know, have faith. And then the first international, it was as a result again of thinking kindly of people, because in 1975, when they had the international in Denver, Colorado, there were three people. We'll have about 300 from Australia at Minneapolis. And there were three people came from Australia. There was Bob Jay from Canberra, and Jimmy Mack, the bookmaker, from Brisbane, and Eve from Al-Anon in Deniliquin, in New South Wales. And instead of me saying what a lot of other people said, why should we go to America, you know, to enjoy Alcoholics Anonymous, have some fun? I don't want to have any fun. I can remember when I was involved with one of the intergroups there, and I was in a new town, and I said to these people, I said, when do you have a convention? When do you have a bit of celebration here? When do you have a bit of a party? And I heard one guy said, parties and celebrations in Alcoholics Anonymous, you ever heard of anything so ridiculous? Anyhow, I said, hang around here, son. I said, you'll get to eat more cake than you've ever seen. He said, I hate cake. Anyhow, a few years later, I saw him at a convention, and he's waffing into the cake, and I said, you still hate it? Anyhow, he just grinned, you know. But anyhow, this first convention where these three people said they were going, I thought, wow, I wonder whether we could do that one day. Well, we didn't go to Denver because it was nearly upon us. But we went to New Orleans, and then we went to Montreal, and then we went to Seattle, and Carmen wasn't able to make it to San Diego, but I went to San Diego, and by the grace of God, we'll move from here tomorrow to Hartford, and then on Monday to Minneapolis. Now, my plea out of that is, you know, that there's someone in the room that's thinking, even with Minneapolis, there might be someone in the room with two minds to it. Going to be the biggest celebration of Alcoholics Anonymous ever experienced in the world. The biggest meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Sure, it's not like our home group where we know everyone and that, but to get in a Superdome and hold hands with possibly 100,000 people and say the Lord's Prayer. I hope the structural steel on that, if it's an enclosed Superdome there, that it's well bolted down, it'll lift off, you know. As we felt before when people were, you know, contributing in that, how it works, and that to feel the Spirit move, to see the light come in the eyes of a newcomer, to see it in my daughter who, as I said, just had a separation, and to see not a deterioration in her life but an improvement in her program, you know, because she was determined to give the best to those two young children that she'd been left with. And he did a couple of wrong things, the son-in-law, and as I said, he eventually picked up a drink. But before he picked up a drink, rather than her be bitter, she said, you know, Daddy's still an alcoholic. And I felt the compassion of one alcoholic for another. And so I'll finish as quick as I can. I used to say I'll finish now, I'm going for 20 minutes. So I'll try and keep it honest by saying I'll finish as quick as I can. When we first got sober and we were in Darwin and we had a public meeting, and we had a guy from the Salvation Army and a guy from somewhere else and a Catholic priest were non-alcoholic speakers. And they spoke, you know, wonderfully about Alcoholics Anonymous. And the priest at the end said, he said, I can give them a voucher to get some food. He said, I can probably even arrange some accommodation for them. He said, I can probably even find them a few dollars. He said, I can probably get the heat taken off of them with the police and things like that. He said, but I can't give what one alcoholic can give, the compassion and understanding. And it can't be described, it's got to be lived. And it can only be experienced through anything I've said tonight is through my own experience, strength and hope. But it's only through those steps. I find it easier to work my life according to the dictates of those steps rather than find ways around avoiding issues. You know, there are issues that have to be, as I said, that photography thing, you know, that. There was a time where we started a breakfast meeting. I was involved with starting the first early morning meeting in Australia, 6 a.m. actually it was. And now they get about 200 people there during the week, and on a Saturday, no, sorry, during the week they get about 80 people, 6 a.m. and then Saturday and Sunday they have a bit of a sleep in. They start at 7 a.m. and they get about 200 there. Now, when we started that, it was in Denny's restaurant, American chain. And I thought, and was on a main street in a holiday resort area of Australia, and I thought it would be ideal to have a sign in the window, Alcoholics Anonymous, blah, blah, blah. And I thought, you know, what a tremendous idea you've come up with, John. And, you know, we put it to the group conscience, and it was one of the newcomers said, I wouldn't have come here if people had known that this was an alcoholic, and I've got a business in this town. And I thought, she's right, you know. And yet I was so convinced, and yet the importance of the unity, the importance of what I've seen here this weekend, you might not, be as aware of, and I'm not saying this in a condescending way, I'm just saying you've got such an enormous fellowship here, you know, that sometimes we can miss the obvious. Sometimes we can take it for granted. Sometimes, like my son-in-law, you know, and I'm not pointing a finger at him, I'm just saying, you know, it takes a steady hand to hold a full cup. And the more we give, or the more that's given to us, the more that's expected of us. So for me to be here, and, you know, I was thinking about today, and I thought, why did I commit to Diane to do this deal, you know? Why did I commit to bring a coat for one stint here at Sabrefest, you know? All those sort of things that would allow me to be less grateful than to say, you know, God loves you, I love you, my family love you. We talked to our daughters beforehand, and they're, you know, strictly programmed people, and they said, be sure to give our best wishes to the people of Sabrefest in Connecticut. And they've never been here. They've been to Boston and places like that when they've been to international conventions and that, but, you know, to have that extended so far around the world by girls who really mean it and are really excited for you people just as much as we are, and they haven't even met you. So my brother used to say, I came with friends to be with friends that I haven't met, but when we leave, we'll all be friends. And thank you for the opportunity to share with you. May God bless you and keep you. Thank you very much.